Welcome to Mind Walk, produced at Upstart Radio for Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Radio Free Moscow, IndieMedia.org, RadioForAll.net, community and micropower stations worldwide.
It is my desire, if not my duty, to try to talk to you journeymen with some candor about what is happening to radio and television. And if what I say is responsible, I alone am responsible for the saying of it. Our history will be what we make of it. And if there are any historians about 50 or 100 years from now, and there should be preserved the kinescopes of 1 week of all three networks, they will there find, recorded in black and white and in color, evidence of decadence, escapism, and insulation from the realities of the world in which we live. We are currently wealthy, fat, comfortable, and complacent. We have a built-in allergy to unpleasant or disturbing information. Our mass media reflect this. But unless we get up off our fat surpluses and recognize that television, in the main, is being used to distract, delude, amuse, and insulate, then television and those who finance it, those who look at it, and those who work at it may see a totally different picture too late. I began by saying that our history will be what we make it. If we go on as we are, then history will take its revenge and retribution will not limp in catching up with us. Just once in a while, let us exalt the importance of ideas and information. Let us dream to the extent of saying that on a given Sunday night, the time normally occupied by Ed Sullivan is given over to a clinical survey on the state of American education. And a week or two later, the time normally used by Steve Allen is devoted to a thoroughgoing study of American policy in the Middle East. Would the corporate image of their respective sponsors be damaged? Would the shareholders rise up in their wrath and complain? Would anything happen other than a few million people would have received a little illumination on subjects that may well determine the future of this country and therefore the future of the corporations? To those who say people wouldn't look, they wouldn't be interested, they're too complacent, indifferent, and insulated, I can only reply, there is, in one reporter's opinion, considerable evidence against that contention. But even if they are right, what have they got to lose? Because if they are right, and this instrument is good for nothing but to entertain, amuse, and insulate, then the tube is flickering now, and we will soon see that the whole struggle is lost. This instrument can teach. It can illuminate, and yes, it can even inspire. But it can do so only to the extent that humans are determined to use it towards those ends. Otherwise, it is merely wires and lights in a box. Good night, and good luck.
We go live now to the United Nations. Here is U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton, talking about Iran.
Council action just as soon as possible. With that, maybe I'll stop and take a few questions.
Ambassador, the Security Council gave Iran 30 days the first time. How much more time are you prepared, or do you want the Council to give Iran this time around?
We've been discussing a very short turnaround period for compliance with the resolution, but as with many things in the Security Council, we'll require discussions with the other members, but our view is it should be a very short period.
Quite often about the credibility of the UN, and it seems
and so has Secretary Rice.
Yes, and Rice has as well, but that seems to work in your favor when they do what you want them to do, but you violated the UN charter when you went to war against Iraq, and you consistently lied to us about the reasons that we went to war. And this war was drawn up in Herzliya, Israel, in 1996 with the project of a new American century. And, you know, why do you have credibility other than that you've just got the biggest guns?
May I ask what media outlet you're from?
News Weekly.
I see.
Why do you have credibility other than that you've just got the biggest guns? You violated the UN charter when you went to war against Iraq, and you consistently lied to us about the reasons that we went to war.
I'm not sure I could you say, time heals everything, but I'm still waiting. I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me to figure out. I've paid a price, and I'll keep paying. I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down. I'm still mad as hell, and I don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right. I probably wouldn't if I could, 'cause I'm mad as hell. Can't bring myself to do what it is you think.
Cleveland, Mr. President, and to the City Club. My question is that author and former Nixon administration official Kevin Phillips, in his latest book, American Theocracy, discusses what has been called radical Christianity and its growing involvement into government and politics. He makes the point that members of your administration have reached out to prophetic Christians who see the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism as signs of the apocalypse. Do you believe this, that the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism are signs of the apocalypse? No. And if not, why not?
The answer is, I haven't really thought of it that way. Here's how I think of it. First, I've heard of that, by the way. I guess I'm more of a practical fella. I vowed after September the 11th that I would do everything I could to protect the American people. And, no, hold on for a second, please. Excuse me. No president wants war. Everything you may have heard is that, but it's just simply not true. My attitude about the defense of this country changed on September the 11th. When we got attacked, I vowed then and there to use every asset at my disposal to protect the American people. Our foreign policy changed on that day, Helen. You know, we used to think we were secure because of oceans and previous diplomacy. But we realized on September 11, 2001, that killers could destroy innocent life. And I'm never going to forget it. And I'm never going to forget the vow I made to the American people that we will do everything in our power to protect our people. Part of that meant to make sure that we didn't allow people to provide safe haven to an enemy. And that's why I went into Iraq. Hold on for a second. Look. Excuse me for a second, please. Excuse me for a second. They did. The Taliban provided safe haven for al-Qaeda. That's where al-Qaeda trained and... Excuse me. Afghanistan provided safe haven for al-Qaeda.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year. With the blood and the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear, you might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before. Where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. And does a shadow on the faces of the men who send the gun to the wars that I fought in places where the business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, on the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own. Other people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lives in the balance. There are people under fire, there are children at the cannons, there is blood on the wire. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who fanned the flames of the wars that I fought in places we can't even say the names. They sell us the president the same way they sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion the same time they sell us our wars. I wanna know who the men shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. It can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people under fire, there are children at the cannons, there is blood on the wire. And there are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons, there are. Thank you.
practice of not commenting on potential personnel moves.
Of course I do.
Calling it speculation.
And you can understand why. Because we got people's reputations at stake. And on Friday I stood up and said I don't appreciate the speculation about Don Rumsfeld. He's doing a fine job. I strongly support him.
Critics believe that you're ignoring the advice of retired generals and military commanders who say that there needs to be a change.
I say I listen to all voices, but mine's the final decision. And Don Rumsfeld is doing a fine job. He's not only transforming the military, he's fighting a war on terror. He's helping us fight a war on terror. I have strong confidence in Don Rumsfeld. I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation. But I'm the decider, and I decide what is best, and what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
We have two oil men in the White House. The logical follow-up from that is $3 a gallon gasoline. It is no accident. Too wedded to the oil companies. Too wedded to the oil companies. We have two oil men in the White House. The logical follow-up from that is $3 a gallon gasoline. It is no accident. It is a cause and effect. A cause and effect. How dare the President of the United States make a speech today in April, many, many, many months after the American people had to undergo the cost of home heating oil. A woman told me she almost fainted when she received her home heating bill over this winter. And when so many people making the minimum wage, which hasn't been raised in 8 years, which has a very low purchasing power, have to go out and buy gasoline at these prices. Where have you been, Mr. President? The middle class squeeze is on. Competition in our country is affected by the price of energy and of oil. And all of a sudden, you take a trip outside of Washington, see the fact that the public is outraged about this, come home and make a speech. Let's see that matched in your budget. Let's see that matched in your policy. Let's see that matched in your separating yourself from your patron, Big Oil. Cut yourself off from that anvil that is holding this part, your party down and this country down. Instead of coming to Washington and throwing your Republican colleagues under the wheels of the train, which they mightily deserve for being a rubber stamp for your obscene, corrupt policy of ripping off the American people. We have two oil men in the White House. The logical follow-up from that is $3 a gallon gasoline. It is no accident. Too wedded to the oil company.
Thing we have to fear is fear itself. It sometimes seems with the Bush crowd that their motto is the only thing we have to use is fear itself. So I think what you could see coming up on these midterm elections is them trying to use fear to restore their political position.
But even in that context, other historical examples, President Reagan rebounded from Iran-Contra and President Clinton rebounded after the impeachment, but Harry Truman did not shake off Korea while troops were still in Korea, and Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon certainly didn't shake off Vietnam while troops were there. Are not the president's poll numbers, and to a large degree his presidency now, absolutely indivisible from our continuing presence in Iraq?
Yeah, I think pretty much, which is why there are not a lot of people who expect him to move very much in the polls. And once you're tagged as an incompetent, that's pretty hard to recover from. I mean, you've got a situation now where, you know, in workplaces across America, if somebody says, he's a real Dick Cheney, what they mean is a guy who sounds like he has a lot of gravitas in those meetings at your company and looks the part, but is actually, you know, kind of full of it and can't get the job done when it comes to making a profit. And so that's where these guys are now, that their credibility for getting the job done has been eroded, I think largely because they surround themselves with these yes men. The truth doesn't get up the chain of command, as we saw with these trailers. So because people feel like if they tell them the truth, they're just going to get their heads bitten off. And as a result, your batting average on decisions goes down, down, down. Your competence level goes down, 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 because you're not making well-informed decisions.
Lieutenant General Greg Newbold, who was in charge of operations before the war, what he wrote in Time magazine this week: the cost of flawed leadership continues to be paid in blood. We need fresh ideas and fresh faces. That means, as a first step, replacing Rumsfeld and many others unwilling to fundamentally change their approach. What's the mentality? A four-star general, a three-star general, meets with the defense secretary. The defense secretary is hell-bent on doing what he wants to do. The generals or general disagrees. At what point do you stand up and say, Mr. Secretary, I have to resign?
You have hit the nail on the head. It's our responsibility as military leaders to stand up and be counted on tough issues. And if that's not done, if they cannot take the intimidation, the micromanagement by this Department of Defense, which there is, if they don't stand up and have the moral courage to stand up and defend their troops and the mission that they've been assigned, then it's their issue, their problem. And I would hope there'd be more of that. I've been saying that for a long time. This does not mean you don't support the troops or you don't support the war even, but it's the method, the tone. And I would hope the secretary would realize all of this. And the micromanagement, though, has got us into a situation where I think we are today.
The argument was that you've heard it, it's written in Cobra 2, this new book by retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General Bernard Traynor, Michael Gordon of the New York Times, that Rumsfeld used to browbeat generals into submission point after point. At the end, they just would throw up their hands. Rumsfeld did not trust the generals to send the minimum force necessary to win and secure the peace, and he wanted to be able to cut off the flow of reinforcements and support units if they were deemed unnecessary once the war was underway. Those are pretty strong words.
Look, when an officer makes four-star general, if he doesn't have the conies to stand up and be counted on tough issues and to push back, then he shouldn't be wearing four stars as far as I'm concerned. If he gets intimidated by a Secretary of Defense to the point where he won't give his best, his honest, clear advice and push that issue until a decision is made, then he shouldn't be wearing four stars. We've got too much of that. And I think we've got to get more officers to stand up and be counted at the table when they're on active duty. I think you're going to see more of that because there is a degree of frustration with the way things are going.
What are you hearing from your friends at the Pentagon, the top three, four-star generals right now behind the scenes? How frustrated, how angry are they with Rumsfeld?
Many of them very much so, particularly the last two or three years. The issue was they don't trust us.
Retired Army Major General John Batiste is in Rochester, New York this morning. General Batiste, good morning to you.
Good morning, Katie. How are you?
Fine, thank you. You have quite a stellar military record of service. You retired last November after 31 years serving your country in Iraq. You led the Army's 1st Infantry Division. Before that, you worked with Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz. Before retiring, you turned down a promotion to 3-star general as the second in command of the forces in Iraq. So why go public with your criticism now?
Katie, this is something that's been building in me for the last 5 years. And as you said, I retired on the 1st of November and transitioned into civilian life. Thought a lot about it, and I feel strongly. I have nothing to gain in doing this. There is no political agenda at all. For 31 years, I was a loyal subordinate and did not tolerate dissension in the ranks. My sole motivation, pure and simple, are the service men and women and their incredible families. But I think it's a question of accountability. Accountability for the war plan that was built to invade Iraq, but failed to build the peace. Accountability for what happened in Abu Ghraib. Accountability for a leadership style, which is intimidating, abusive. There was not a two-way street of respect.
At the same time, though, the president, as you well know, General, is commander-in-chief. Why reserve all your criticism for Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and hold your fire when it comes to the president himself?
My focus is on the Department of Defense. It's what I know.
I guess if you had concerns about this, though, from the get-go, if you had come out publicly, you might have been successful in shaping public opinion far earlier than you are now.
Katie, back then I was a one-star general. I doubt there'd be many people that would have listened to this voice.
I know that there have been five other retired generals, General Batiste, who've stepped forward in the last few weeks calling for Secretary Rumsfeld to resign. Is this effort a coordinated one?
Actually, it's not. I have not talked to the other generals. Accountability for the war plan that was built to invade Iraq, but failed to build the peace. Accountability for what happened in Abu Ghraib. Accountability for a leadership style, which is intimidating, abusive. There was not a two-way street of respect.
President, it's an honor to have you here.
Thanks.
I'm a first-year student in South Asia Studies. My question is in regards to private military contractors. The Uniform Code of Military Justice does not apply to these contractors in Iraq. I asked your Secretary of Defense a couple months ago what law governs their actions. Mr. Rumsfeld,
I'm going to ask him. Go ahead. Help.
Well, I was hoping your answer might be a little more specific. Mr. Rumsfeld answered that Iraq has its own domestic laws, which he assumed apply to those private military contractors. However, Iraq is clearly not currently capable of enforcing its laws, much less against, you know, over our American military contractors. I would submit to you that in this case, this is one case that privatization is not a solution. And Mr. President, how do you propose to bring private military contractors under a system of law?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. I wasn't kidding. I'd pick up the phone and say, Mr. Secretary, I got an interesting question. This is what delegation, I don't mean to be dodging the question, although it's kind of convenient in this case, but never. I really will. I'm going to call the secretary and say, you brought up a very valid question, and what are we doing about it? That's how I work. Thanks. I'm going to call the secretary and say, you brought up a very valid question, and what are we doing about it? That's how I work. Thanks.
This has been Mind Walk, an Upstart Radio production.